Hello, and welcome to the 14th episode of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm joined as ever by my co-host, David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hi, Perry.
How's it all going?
Oh, not bad. Surviving.
Well, that's good to hear. Later on in this particular episode, we have got a long interview with Melbourne researcher and writer Lucy Sussex. We would like to point out that we recorded this at Lucy's place last week on a Saturday in her kitchen. It has a corrugated iron roof, and there was a bit of rain around on that particular day. So from time to time, you're going to hear rain hitting the roof in the background. We like to think of this as being atmosphere. You may find it to be, well, the production values aren't great. Well, more interested in the interview rather than the major production values that you might get from a professional podcast. But anyway, we just think it adds a bit to the atmosphere, so that'll be coming up a bit later. But in the meantime, David, before we get to that, there was one thing that I wanted to follow up on what we were talking about last week. I did actually listen to the podcast all the way through, as much as some people might think that we don't, but
I listened to them all, I think. Because particularly the older ones, you sort of forget what you said. And so it can be quite interesting to look back and figure out what you've actually been saying.
Yes, and then you sort of think, God, did I really say that?
Yeah, anyway, that's true. There's quite a bit of that.
It is a bit of a problem.
Yeah, and we've also been picked up from time to time by people saying, that's not right, you should have looked that up on Google before you started talking about that. Well, we don't work that way.
No, this is always set up to being a conversation between two people. And as you know, with conversations between two people, some of it's accurate and some of it's, well, maybe
totally
not quite
wrong.
So accurate.
Completely wrong.
It might have a bit of semblance to truth about it, but it's probably a truth only inside of our heads rather than being actually true. But if we make mistakes, like the fact I think a couple of episodes ago, I seem to apply that Eric Frank Russell was an American writer when he was actually British, quite happy to correct statements of fact that we get wrong. That's not a problem at all. But last week I was listening to the episode and listening to me talk about the Hugos and how the Hugos went at the 2019, and also how some information about the changes that were happening in the science fiction field. And I sort of think I wasn't quite as particular as I could have been in terms of the way that I feel about that. I came out with that thinking, maybe it was just the tone of my voice at the time I was saying it. It sort of gave me the impression that if I was listening to it dispassionately, that I wasn't happy about the changes that are currently undergoing in the field. Well, let me state right here now, that's completely opposite to that. I am very happy with what is going on. I'm of the view that any literary field that stays static is going to fade away and disappear. And I would think that you and I would agree on this, David, that we don't want the science fiction and fantasy fields to fade away and disappear.
No, indeed.
We'd rather they basically kept on moving. Now, the way I see it, if you have a look at all of the books that are recommended, say, by Locus in their recommended reading list, that list is getting wider in terms of subject matter and voices. It is getting longer in terms of just the sheer volume of the number of books that have been picked up. That leads me to believe that the science fiction, fantasy, speculative fiction, whatever you want to call it, genres are moving further out so that we're getting more and more people coming into the field and writing from their own experience, using their own voices and their own backgrounds. I think that's a wonderful thing. I really, really enjoy that. It does not mean that the stuff that we may have liked when we were 14 or 15 is not any longer being written, because of course it is. In fact, there's probably as much of it being written now as there was when we were 14 or 15, David.
Oh, far more, I would have thought. Far more.
Yeah, there's everything has just increased. The amount of material coming out means that you could find whatever you want in the field. You will recall a few years back, David, with the so-called puppies who basically had this big protest about the Hugo Awards because they could believe that the Hugo Awards were pretty much leaving them behind, that everybody was the so-called social justice warrior. In other words, it was non-old white guys writing stuff. Well, stuff that old white guys write can be quite good, but a whole lot of stuff that non-old white guys write can be also really quite good. And I don't see what the problem is. There's plenty of it available, and I'm quite happy for it, to be perfectly frank. I think it's great. And if I gave the impression last week that I was maybe a little less than happy, I apologise for that.
I didn't interpret what you said in that light at all, but I suppose some people might have. So it's worth making that sort of correction. At some point, not this episode, but we must have a discussion, I think, about whether the Hugo Awards and the Nebula Awards are actually a good representation of what is being written, the best of what is being written in speculative fiction, because I'm not so sure that it is. I think there's a lot of very good material being written, which never gets nominated and never gets mentioned in the Locus Awards and so on. But I could be wrong about that, but it's a discussion worth having. I think we'll have that sometime.
It is, and I think that would then lead us on to talking about the other awards in the field. I mean, really, so far we've spoken about the Hugo, the Nebula, the Locus Award, but there's a whole lot of others. There's the World Fantasy Award, there's the Shirley Jackson, the Prometheus, the Philip K. Dick Award, the John W. Campbell Memorial Award, the Clark Award, the British Science Fiction Association Award. I think I've spoken about that once or twice. There's a whole heap of stuff that basically is out there. But in order for you to be able to get a good view about where the whole of the field is, you need to be across all of that. Mm. And that's a big effort. That takes a lot of work. Anybody that can do that, as far as I'm concerned, is pretty good. I'm gradually catching up on certain years. So there might be one year where I've read just about all of the major award winners. But I'm always two or three years well back in terms of being able to do that. But yes, I think they're a good idea to have that discussion.
Yeah. Okay, good.
All right. Well, so I think what we'll do now, David, is pass it over to the interview with Lucy. Yep. And we'll come back at the end.
We'll do that.
Until relatively recently, crime fiction was not held in high regard within the confines of Australian literature. Lately, that has all changed. Peter Temple won the Miles Franklin Award with a crime novel, and a new wave of women crime writers, such as Jane Harper, Candace Fox, Sarah Bailey and Dervla McTiernan, amongst many others, have come onto the scene to huge levels of success. And yet, crime fiction has a long history in this country, with examples of the genre appearing in Australian newspapers and magazines in the 1800s, almost as soon as it became recognisable anywhere in the world. And a lot of that early fiction was written by women. Our guest today, Lucy Sussex, is a researcher and writer who has had a big part to play in uncovering that breadth and depth of crime fiction writing in Australia in the 19th and earliest 20th centuries. Hello, Lucy, and welcome to our podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give us some idea of your major discoveries in the crime writing field in Australia?
Well, I suppose that I was the person who discovered Mary Fortune, who had been I discovered the full name and the story behind Mary Fortune. She'd been written as Waif Wanda or WW in the page of the Australian Journal, which was a fiction magazine that lasted from the 1860s to the 1950s, and it had a major crime interest. It had a real focus. And nobody really knew who Waif Wanda WW was, except that it was quite clear she was a woman. And by doing a bit of cross-referencing and looking at her journalism and following up clues in the register of birth, death and marriage, there was suggestions in the 1950s that she was a Mrs. Fortune, but people couldn't get further than that. And then I basically in those days you followed a maze of microfilm, it's all digitised these days, and so she was Mary Helena Fortune. She came to Australian goldfields in the 1850s with a small child. She was on the gold field. She was writing politically radical poetry for the Castlemaine papers. She had an illegitimate child who subsequently turned out to be a career criminal, and that was something that was, you know, I was looking for him for years. I didn't know he was in jug. And she also, for her second marriage, which was bigamous, married a young mounted constable called Percy Rollo Brett, who by his second marriage was the great-grandfather of Judith Brett, the historian.
Oh.
So that was a...
Nice, you know, nice connections going on there.
Oh, yes. And I did a bit of research on Ellen Davitt, who was around about the same time, and she's the one who, after whom the Sisters in Crime Davitt's Awards. And she was a... She wrote Forced and Fraud, which is the first Australian murder mystery. And she turned out to be a sister-in-law of Anthony Trollope, the well-known novelist.
Oh, okay.
And yet somehow had escaped the notice of all the Trollope biographers. So here were two really interesting women at working at a very high level at the beginnings of crime fiction in Australia. And one of them, Fortune, continued on until the early 1900s.
So Davitt was... I think you identified her as being the writer of Australia's first crime novel, or crime novel by a woman, or...?
I'd say first murder mystery novel, and the one Stephen Knight has said it actually anticipates a lot of later murder mystery novels because the trajectory of it. Previously, writers were fiddling around with the form and inserting, you know, romance here and a bit of expository lump there. And in Force and Fraud, which is a novel, it's called A Tale of the Bush, in that everything is subordinate, everything is related in it to the crime, to the murder which happens in the opening chapters and is solved at the end. So all the events are dependent upon that, so it's a very sophisticated anticipation of the form.
So it's a crime novel where everything relates to the crime, as opposed to just being a normal romance novel with a bit of crime thrown in, just to add a bit of spice to the recipe.
Yeah.
So what about Fortune, though? I mean, you talked about Fortune as doing a lot of research on her, but what was her reputation like in the field? Was it a modern reputation that you were picking up on and then doing the research based on that reputation? Or was it that she had a big reputation at the time when she was writing?
She had a big following at the time.
Okay.
But she was pseudonymous and she was hiding from her... her public didn't know who she was, largely because she really was a bit disreputable.
Oh.
A bit of an alcoholic as
so,
well.
So that explains the reason behind the
the
strange pseudonyms that were hard to track down.
Yeah, and she did feel herself to be a bit of a waif and a wanderer. She was a genuine bohemian. And lived both in Upper Bohemia, which was, you know, the literary dilettantes, and Lower Bohemia, which was the criminal class. So she knew both. But because what she is, she's very important in that she anticipates the police procedural. Because she was married to a policeman, she knew quite a lot about police procedure, and she also followed crimes quite intensively. So she has, unlike Davitt, who doesn't have a police detective, and I should explain that around about the 1860s, and this persisted for some time, police were considered a bit lower in social class. In Australia, they were often Irish, and that was, again, the dominant Protestant, rulers of colonial Victoria. This was, a little bit de classe. And so police, therefore, they couldn't really be the centre for heroes. They'd be comic relief. And even, if you know Dickens, he's got Inspector Bucket,
Yes. All
these daft names. But Fortune was writing stories where her detective, who's called Mark Sinclair, is the hero, and the reason he could be a hero in colonial Victoria was that in the 1850s they had a program of improving the police by recruiting middle-class young men who maybe had a bit of militia or experience in the Crimea or something like that, but who were recruited into the police, particularly the mounted police. So you could use that sort of protagonist quite without any problems of class.
So you mentioned around the 1860s. When was
So when did Davitt write her novel?
Well, she this is 1865.
All right, and
Fortune starts writing very soon after. She's inspired by what's going on in the Australian Journal with its crime emphasis on crime fiction. But at the same time, on the other side of the world, the French writer Émile Gaboriau, who's French and is often called the missing link before Doyle, he starts writing his police procedural, so everything's happening at once. But there's no way that these things can they know what's going on in France at the time?
No, there wouldn't have been a cross-pollination of the literature at that
stage. Not yet, but so it's suddenly it's an idea whose time has come.
So the Australian public would have been receiving some of the newspapers and magazines from England as they turned up, but that would have been fairly patchy. So, but they would have been seeing bits and pieces of it. So the bulk of the fiction they would have been reading at the time came from the Australian newspapers and magazines?
Well, they were picking up on English crimes via sort of cable.
Yeah.
But actually they were huge readers of imported newspapers and journals, not only from England. It took about 3 months. So you'd get Household Words with Dickens, and that would turn up in Australia, a couple of months later, and then across the Pacific came stuff from America.
Mm-hmm.
So there was actually, and these imported periodicals were a bit cheaper than the local produce, so that there was intense appetite for reading. But particular crime, because Australians were fascinated with crime for a very good reason, in that you still had old legs from Tasmania emigrating to Victoria and causing havoc. Or you still had WA in Queensland, which still had a degree of transportation. So there was this dialogue going on between true crime and fictional crime.
Okay.
So I'm just trying to compare with what was going on in England, because Wilkie Collins' The Moonstone is sometimes nominated as one of the first detective novels. But that was 1868, I'm just looking it up. So that was really after what was happening here with Davitt.
So, yeah, these novels actually preceded The Moonstone.
Mm.
And there's a chance that there was a reverse migration going on of Australian newspapers going back to England, and certainly Australian writers were trying to. There was a writer called James Skip Borlase, who was Mary Fortune's collaborator. Well, he was able to place crime stories in an English magazine, and then in about 1867, he had his own book of crime short stories out in England.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of two-way process.
So were these crime stories with Australian settings?
Yeah.
Well, they were. And they sold.
Yeah, it was very much the land of opportunity and the gold rushes, the big rush of the alluvial rushes of the 1850s, where people thought you could pick up gold and the street had gone. But there was this fascination with Australia as a land of opportunity.
Big and wide and
empty,
and it still considers that the climate's better. Mm. We just keep on going on and listing all of the advantages, and so. There was a lot of crime fiction being written at that time, much of it by women. I know we've mentioned here Fortune and Davitt. Were there any others that were going around at the time?
The really big seller was a woman called Mary Braddon, who's a terrific writer, the major rival to Wilkie Collins.
Okay.
And she's another one who was a little bit shady, because she was actually living with her publisher in Sin, because he had a mad wife in an asylum and they couldn't get married. In fact, they couldn't get married until something like 6 kids later, when she died, and whereupon
the wife died.
Yeah, the wife. The wife died, so they could get married.
And she was Australian as well.
No, she was Irish English.
She was Irish English, right?
But she was a huge bestseller and had a fortune rips her off at certain times. But Miss Braddon.
No samples. Samples, Lucy. You don't rip anybody off in the literary world. You sample.
Yes.
As long as you don't plagiarise, you can't have a copyright or intellectual property on an idea. So as long as you utilise it and utilise it properly and put it in a different locale, you're fine.
Yeah.
Theoretically. Yeah.
But she was huge. Mrs. Henry Wood, Ellen Wood, was also writing crime fiction, but King's Lynn was a East Lynn was a major bestseller. So there was a lot. There was a lot going on in book level, but there was also a lot going on in magazines and serialised novels, etc.
And in Australia, was Fortune and Davitt were the two major ones?
Yeah, they were the two major ones. There was some degree, but Fortune pretty much cornered the short crime fiction market, and she held on to it for a very long time.
There's just from some of my research. There's a lot of work in the early newspapers where it was all with pseudonyms or even without a byline at all, so you had no idea who actually wrote it, or if there was a person's name, it was very much the idea, well, let's just sort of muddy the waters of the gender by putting in the initials, and that was all. So you really, if you know who the author is and you can track them down and know that they've written other stuff, then you're okay. But if it's just initials, you just got absolutely no idea what the gender is at all.
So. Well, Marcus Clark used MC, and that's so. And using that, you can trace that in 1865, it's probably the first Australian short detective story, which is called Wonderful, and appeared in the Hamilton Spectator, and he was like a teenager. This is a very bright teenager, but he's interested in crime. He owns crime fiction books, and then he writes his Natural Life, which is not only the true crime of Tasmania, but in its the original version is serialised in the Australian Journal, which he happened to be editing at the time, God knows how. It's more of a murder mystery in structure, but when they revised it for book publication, that went. So he was certainly very aware of what was going on too.
So each of the instalments of his Natural Life would have had a sort of a cliffhanger sort of arrangement at the end and what's going to happen next, and ran it almost like an adventure crime novel.
Yes, except on occasions when he simply hadn't actually produced a copy, and the story goes that his publisher locked him in a room until he produced it.
Wish that there's a few other authors that we could possibly name whose publishers would do that.
You don't let our big brother
do the same. Oh, yes. Well, there's that old story of Douglas Adams. He said he used to love deadlines. He loved the sound of them whooshing by. So we get through to the 1860s and 1870s, and then we move on to a bit later where a fairly major novel is published in Melbourne.
Oh, yeah, this is The Mystery of the Hansom Cab, which was by Fergus Hume, and it was the quickest and also really one of the first crime blockbusters, which is why I called my book on the subject blockbuster, because it was one of those books that just takes off, and next thing you know, it's being pirated in French and Norwegian and being dramatised as a play. And it was everywhere at once. And Fergus Hume was a lawyer from Dunedin. His father ran the madhouse, the asylum, to be more polite and correct.
That's okay. We know what you're talking about.
Yeah. But he wanted to be a playwright. His father said, you know, laddie, you've got to get a profession. And so he became a lawyer, which he hated. And almost as soon as he got his law degree, he was off to Melbourne, which was sort of next step, because he wanted to become a successful playwright. And Melbourne was the centre for theatre in colonial, the seven Austral colonies, because New Zealand wasn't separate. So the big theatre area was Melbourne. So he went there, and he couldn't actually manage to get into the theatre scene. So he thought he'd write a novel, and they couldn't deny him entry. And as his story was that he went to a bookseller and said, "What's selling?" This bookseller says, "Oh, Gaboriau, the Frenchman." Mm. And so he buys all 11 Gaboriau novels and probably a few of Gaboriau's followers as well, takes them and reads them. I thought, okay, well, what I need here is local colour. Well, just, you know, so he's wandering around Melbourne and Melbourne had the feature that you could go from Collins Street, the high society, and go down into Lily Burke and Lily Lonsdale, and there was the slums. So you could move between areas of social areas and research. So he was trotting around Melbourne doing lots of local colour. And he nailed colonial Victoria very well, because he was an outsider. And he could see the anxiety of this place that had come from nowhere, and people becoming incredibly rich, but at the same time left their old lives back in England. But who is to know when, you know, sort of a a wife who had been left behind and abandoned might turn up, or some scandal might erupt. So you could see that the place was built on sand. And so he starts to think about this, and he comes up with the idea, and he's borrowing from one of Gaborio's followers who had murdered in an omnibus. So Roberta thinks, oh yeah, hansom cab. So the story was he was going to a swish party, going down St Kilda Road, and thinks, oh hello, you could murder somebody in a hansom cab because nobody would be any the wiser, because the driver's on the outside and he can't see what's going on, and they communicated through a hatch in the roof. And so that was his idea. So it begins with newspaper coverage of a body that's been discovered inside a hansom cab, and just goes from there into this picture of colonial Melbourne as it was, and very tightly, very carefully plotted. It goes from high life to low life, and it's a very detailed picture of the place as it was.
From a modern crime reader's perspective, it's got a strange structure to it, in that there doesn't seem to be a central detective character to it.
There are two, aren't there?
Yeah, and there's sort of just change. There's one half of it that goes one way, and then it moves over, and then the families take over afterwards.
Mm.
There's not that whole flow through from beginning to end.
That's largely because I think Hume was from New Zealand, so he didn't really know that you had this core of people who were middle class police, and in fact, one of them ended up as Hussey Malone Chumley, believe it or not, ended up as chief commissioner. So he didn't actually know this. So he's still got prejudice against police.
Mm.
So he doesn't want to make one of them detective. And you can also see this in Davitt's novel, this model of somebody does a bit of detection and somebody else chips in, and then the family get involved, which was actually reasonably realist. Because for the time.
Because of the detectives, or, well, the police almost wouldn't have had a sort of a detective section at all, would they, at that point?
Oh, they did. They actually had a Chinese detective in colonial Victoria.
Really?
Yeah.
There's a subject.
Yeah. Oh, look, I think there's a book in him for someone to write. But set the adventures of the Chinese detective in colonial Victoria. There's a great opportunity, but it's just the sense that you don't get quite the sense of the great detective until maybe Doyle and Sherlock Holmes.
Mm. Is this because of the way the police worked, or the way that the cases were reported in the newspapers?
There was beginning to be a sort of report reportage which really valorized the police and the detectives, and they were being seen as heroes, but it was a very slow process over the 19th century. And if you look at Holmes, he's not a policeman, but Lestrade is takes his hat off and goes to goes to Holmes for help. So it's snobbery with violence. But yeah, so it has a strange structure if you don't really know that this really predates the hero detective.
Strange was probably not the best word to use in that instance, but it's just different from from what we're used to.
Yeah.
And the idea that you've got, maybe two or three, the classic, Rankin books with John Reavis and Siobhan Clarke and Malcolm Fox all sort of moving around together and sort of moving from the start through to the finish, and they all come in and put their little bits in, but they are all working as a pseudo team.
Yeah.
Whereas in this instance, there is no team. There's somebody that does some work at the beginning, and the private detective is engaged and gets up to a certain point, and then the family takes over afterwards. So they don't really work together. And that's the difference in it. So I meant strange in the sense of different rather than strange terribly weird and, not worth countenancing. Because it's quite an interesting book. And as you said, and I think that it actually is a good point, that it brings – it's all good crime novels, I think, even the ones that are around at the moment, are commentaries on the society in which the crime has been committed, and you get a good view about what happens. And I'm certain that you do here. You get that higher level club arrangement all the way right down, as you say, to the washerwomen, the waifs in the streets, and the brothel owners that were literally only two or three streets away. So you get the whole bit.
It's almost like the city of Melbourne is a character, and that's something that the best crime novels do, in which the setting determines everything.
Marvellous Melbourne, as it was called at the time.
Yeah.
Which has come down to haunt the city for a long period of time.
Marvellous Summer, I suppose. That's right. Yeah.
So that was a really big seller in this in Australia, and then it started to move overseas as well.
It's very interesting. I mean, Blockbuster is as much about the publishing history, because Hume was a fairly elusive character and for very good reasons, which I'll get to later. But Hume couldn't sell his work to publishers in Melbourne, because the chief publisher was George Robertson, was a very Calvinistic Scot, and he wasn't going to countenance the lowlife scenes and the frank immorality. And there were other people around, like Cole of the Book Arcade, but he hadn't actually published any books. And so they just didn't know what to do with it. And I think he might have taken it to the Australian Journal, and they said, well, we've already got a crime novelist on our, crime writer on our staff. So he's stuck. And he happens to meet up with Fred Trishler. And Fred Trishler is a young man who's been knocking around the book trade, and he's a bit of a loose end, and he's also very... Trishler's very smart. He's brilliant at publicity. And Trishler comes across the manuscript, sits up all night reading it, and goes, right, this is fabulous, we've got to publish this. And so he and Hume set out to semi-self-publish. It would have cost a lot of money to bring out, so my theory is that they were playing the stock market, and they earned the money that way. And then they bring out the book around about, with some absolutely... Trish is just brilliant. He gets Hume to deliver the book to booksellers in a hansom cab.
Mm-hmm.
And then they bring it around out at Melbourne Cup Week, when the population of the city has just swelled, and you've got a horse on the front cover, you know. Mm. And I wouldn't have put Trishler to have had a handcart at the Melbourne Cup selling copies.
Mm.
And it said Trishler would claim that there was a print run of 5,000 copies, which is huge even for an Australian novel. They sold out. Now, some book historians disagree with this, but every publisher I spoke to said, got a glint in their eye and said, it's perfectly possible if you've got very good timing and you create a word-of-mouth phenomenon and you strike. So it's possible. And then there's another edition which sells out, and Trishler would claim that they got up to something between 10,000 and 15,000 copies sold before Trishler had the idea to take it to England. At this point, Fergus would really like to get back into his playwriting and doesn't really, he's a bit sick of this. So he rather stupidly sells the copyright to Trishler for £50, which was quite a good rate in those days.
And we're talking 1880s? Late 1880s, 86 or something?
Yeah, quite a good rate. I mean, Doyle only got about £25 for A Study in Scarlet.
Mm. Which isn't a good book, to be frank. But anyway, we can talk about that at another time.
So Trishler takes the book to England and sets up a printing press and basically prints thousands of copies over something like a 14-month period, and gets it to railway booksellers, advertises in just about every newspaper he can possibly manage. Where did he get his money from? Well, his partner was the wife of a bank manager, Jessie Pearson, as her husband was subsequently done for bank fraud, I'm inclined to think that he defrauded the bank to balance the hansom cab.
Oh, I see. Yeah, all right.
Crime upon crime.
So you get true white collar crime adding to the success of the book, and it's a huge success. And what it arguably does is it creates the market for the publishing category of detective fiction, because that label's only really come into existence in the 1880s.
So this book is the one that kicked a lot of things off in Britain, in the British publishing circles.
I would argue.
Detective fiction. Oh, okay.
I would argue, yes.
That's a,
because it predates Doyle.
Yeah.
As in, the Doyle actually has a lot of trouble trying to get Study in Scarlet out, and he sells it on poor terms. And he's not at all pleased at the Hansom cabbies. He thinks that it's been sold by puffery. But what Doyle actually benefits from this, arguably, because I think publishers see there's gold, and so they offer Doyle space to continue with homes in the Strand. And so, and then there's a whole lot of other novels as well in the 1880s, 1890s, which seem to be riding this wave, and it just keeps on going. It's never really stopped.
You said earlier that there was a lot of interest in Australia in the English publishing circles because of its, firstly, the gold rush, and then secondly, that wide open space, a new frontier that was, you know, basically colonised by Britain. Mm. And so they had a view of it. Do you think that the mystery of the Hansom Cab coming from Melbourne being a view of another society, but one that was recognisable enough, was partly due to its success, that it actually came from Australia?
I think so. Well, it was just exotic enough.
Yeah, not too alien, but just enough. Yeah.
And Melbourne was, at the time, the richest city in the Southern Hemisphere.
Mm.
Mind you, a few years later, they had a major subprime crisis and it all went belly up. But at the time, it was really a hot topic, you know, the marvellous Melbourne. Although, but when Melbourne had the big crash in the beginning of the 1890s, it took a very long time to recover. So it never quite had that allure for quite a long while.
So the book was doing really well here. It was doing really well in the UK. What about the States? Did it kick off there
at all?
It
got pirated in the States.
Oh, yes, of course.
There were... Another aspect of the phenomenon was that there were very successful plays, but for some reason not in the States. But America by that stage had a reasonably homegrown crime industry of its own. But, yes, certainly the Hansom Cabs being published in America, but I don't think Hume saw any of the profits.
No, the copyright laws were non-existent, really, weren't they? Between Britain and the US in those days. Charles Dickens complains bitterly about it.
Oh, yes, and I think it took a very long time to resolve and a lot of, it took a lot of agitation. But then literature was a really dicey business at that stage. You could be ripped off. And I'd argue that Fergus Hume got ripped off because he didn't think the book would be successful, and had he kept his copyright, he would have never had to. You know, he would have been comfortably off for the rest of his life.
Yeah. So a number of theatre productions were made of the book.
Yeah.
And that basically traipsed all around Australia, I guess, and New Zealand and the UK.
Oh, yes, very, very big in the UK. And it was a lovely story about how they created publicity in London, and that they hired a Hansom cab, had a corpse, a bloodstained dummy hanging out of it. And then a whole sandwich board men accompanying it, and of course there was a riot. And that was even more publicity. So, yeah.
What publishers would give today to be able to get away with something like that and get a riot over their books?
Absolutely.
Oh, yes, they'd give just about anything. So the book's a big success, but Fergus Hume doesn't really make a lot of money out of it after he sold the rights to it for 50 quid. What happens to him? Where does he go?
He eventually goes to England and he is still setting out to be a playwright. And he has follow-up novels which are published by Trishler, and they're not quite as successful. But he eventually falls out with Trishler, goes to other publishers. And the rest of his life is something, it's about 140 novels bouncing between publishers. He's got a reasonable reputation, but he begins to be eclipsed in the early 20th century. And so he's still writing in the 1920s.
Really?
And until very close to the end of his life when he has an operation, and that he said that destroyed his imaginative ability, but you can still find him doing reviews of crime fiction. So he still was keeping an eye on what was happening, but he was living in a small village in Essex, and he was not by no means a wealthy man.
So he missed out on his opportunity of making all of his money from his big blockbuster.
Yeah, and there's also the question of whether he might have been blackmailed as well.
Oh, yes, this is something else that you came up with around about the time you were publishing. The book was being published, wasn't it? But you found something else about him?
Well,
yeah.
Well, when I was researching the book, three people asked me if Ferguson was gay. The third time this happened, I thought, I've really got to look into this. So it's a really hideous area to try and research because it's so covert. But yeah. In the 19th century, it was illegal. Law around about 1885, the law got really tough. Until the 1830s, you could be hanged for it.
Mm-hmm.
Capital punishment then didn't apply, but you could still, if you were still prosecuted, that was quite severely affect your reputation. You had to prove for a successful prosecution, you had to prove sodomy. They widened the definition of the law in 1885 to include any homosexual act between men, and the evidence could be anything like love letters, whatever. So there was this covert gay culture which was under the radar, and occasionally would rise to the surface, as with the most famous case of Oscar Wilde. And Oscar Wilde was actually blackmailed for love letters, and he paid people off. And Hume, I looked at his work, and I'm going, my God, some of this is incredibly homoerotic. And there's reports of him in New Zealand being. He was seen to be Wildian in dress and manner, and reports of him suggested that he was almost like an Antipodean Oscar Wilde, who was much more discreet. And I thought there was enough evidence to say, yes, there was evidence supporting being gay. And I couldn't actually say that there was proof. And then after the book was out, I knew that Hume had paid quite a large sum of money to a young man called Gordon Lawrence, who's quite famous in gay annals because he was arrested for soliciting in drag at the Melbourne General Exhibition in a bustle, and ended up in Pentridge. But this was actually after Hume had left Australia, and I thought, why on earth has he given this large money, sum of money, to this young man who's subsequently gets arrested? Yeah, it becomes notorious. And as Kerry Greenwood, consulted Kerry Greenwood, and she said, well, it had to be infatuation or blackmail, and blackmail was really common at the time, because when they widened the law to include, all acts, it was created something that was called the Blackmailer's Charter. So quite often it was lowlife who were render boys who were actually blackmailing their clients. And this is probably what happened with Wilde as well. But I didn't have proof. Although I say, look, he gave money to Gordon Lawrence for some reason, probably nefarious. And then after the book was out, just in time for the Sydney Mardi Gras of the following year, an article gets digitised in Trove, which says that, oh yes, Hume was blackmailed, but by a black Shakespearean actor and his accomplice in Sydney, in a particular theatre at the time. So it's very specific. So somebody was in the know, so I then have to track down this gay Shakespearean actors, and actually there weren't that many in Australia at the time, and it was a man called Anthony Bollars, who came down to Melbourne and actually got arrested before Lawrence, in fact, for what looks like a case of soliciting that went slightly wrong. He was cruising in Collins Street and picked up this young man, and they went back to his lodgings and something happened, and the young man went to the police and said, this bloke nicked my diamond typhoon, but it sort of turned up in the pocket of his overcoat. But as the report in Pentridge in the prison record makes quite clear. Bollars was put in jug for indecent assault on a male, which was probably quite consented, probably consenting, but the issue was that the diamond type had went missing and he thought, you know, so
on it,
so you've got two people who a black Shakespearean and his accomplice, and this has to be Bollars and Gordon Lawrence. So it looks like they did a sting on Fergus Hume in Sydney, and he paid them off. But the fact that this made it into the papers was the proof.
Do you think that was one of the reasons why he left Australia, or was it one of the mitigating factors, or did he just leave on the basis of thinking that he could make more money in the UK?
I think it probably didn't help, but I think he was going overseas anyway. But he comes to England and he's noticeably very discreet, unlike Wilde, who's just over the top.
Right.
And he might have been blackmailed subsequently. We haven't got the evidence yet, but it was rife. And the Wilde trial causes a lot of people to duck the cover and go and live in the continent.
Mm. Well, yes, in Paris.
So the story shifts again into queer history, which is another really interesting area. And it looks like he might have been the first that we know of, you know, gay crime writer. But
okay.
How many people don't we know about?
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody really wanted to suffer what happened to Oscar Wilde. So people were very, very careful.
Yes, well, Oscar's problem was that he associated with the son of somebody with a large amount of money who was able to take him to court. And that was where he got into problems. Marcus of Queensbury, wasn't it?
Yep.
Boxing rules and putting the divine Oscar in jail.
Yep.
So what ends up happening to Hume in the end? Does he just basically fade away in the end in the UK?
He sort of fades away and he can't write. And he's living in relative poverty. But he's the other thing is that he's a theosophist. So he's got a psychological means by which he can say, oh, well, this is all because it happened to me in a previous life. And he genuinely believed that he was a French aristocrat who was guillotined during the Terror in a previous life. And he could actually remember being guillotined.
Okay.
And this sustained him. He did have a male companion, a self-served alchemist who was very good at extracting money from people who thought that he was able to persuade people that he could turn, you know, lead into other more valuable substances. And this friend of Hume's with whom they lived together, he had believed he was the reincarnation of Roger Bacon.
Why is it that when people are always going to be reincarnated, they're always some famous aristocrat? Why can't they just be some happy-go-lucky guy in the street
peasant?
All normal peasant. But anyway,
class consciousness even across.
Yes.
Yes. Well, this Arthur Conan Doyle was a bit strange too. Yeah. So he got into the fairies and he got into a lot of stuff.
Spiritualism.
Yeah, that's right. And I think he knew Houdini, and Houdini didn't have a bar of these spiritualists.
Houdini was trying to connect with his dead mother, but Houdini, knowing all the tricks, could see the tricks of the fake mediums, and they kept exposing them. Much to his disappointment, because he really wanted to connect to his mother, but he never found a real medium.
I think Doyle had lost his son during World War One, and he never got over the grief, so he was, you know, he just kept on.
So did, Fergus Hume was there in the UK, he would have been a fairly well-known figure in literary circles. Did he mix with anybody else while he was there?
I would guess that he met Wilde. I think it would have been almost impossible for him not to have met Wilde.
Well, Wilde met everybody, did he?
They were both working in the theatre. Fergus Hume was a literary lion, and so he would have been acquainted with quite a lot of people.
Hmm.
But he fades away. He can't really make it as a playwright in England, if he had written plays, who was to say they were any good? I've yet to read the plays in which are all in the Lord Chamberlain's office in England. And the major Australian playwright at that time in England was there was only room for one Australian playwright, and Haddon Chambers, who also happened to be Nellie Melba's lover. So Nellie was able to have that sort of influence. But, it was what he was really good at was crime writing. And for most of his life, he was able to make a reasonable living from it.
Oh, that's good. So where to now for you? What are you looking into these days? Because the life of a researcher doesn't end. And, I mean, as you've said with some of the things that you're talking about, every time you go down a little path where you're looking for something, you see all these other branches going off all over the place, like your Chinese detective. And I mean, the names that you're bringing up here, this person's connected to this one and to this one. So the research just carries on. But what are you working on? What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working with Megan Brown of Wollongong, and she did a PhD on fortune. We agreed we'd combine forces and write a book together. So we're working separately, but compare bits of just totally communicating via email and Skype, and just comparing notes. So I can say, isn't it funny, this story seems to be about this, and so Megan will come back and say, oh yes it is, and here's another one. And so that's turning into a social history of 19th century Melbourne.
Okay.
And also, Fortune was incredibly self-referential, and as we've discovered, referential about her son as well. And so there's a story about, well, there's a crime writer and her son who is a true criminal, and for all of his life, just about.
Okay. Yeah.
And so that's a kind of juxtaposition which is pretty rare.
Mm.
I don't know of any other instance. And we're putting it all together, and it's been a bit slow, but we've got over 60,000 words, so we're heading towards the conclusion.
Mm. Well, the only other one that I can think of is a certain crime writer who now lives in Scotland who was famous for a particular...
Anne Perry.
...particular crime in New Zealand. Yes, that's right. Who it came out sort of well after she'd been begun to be published as a crime writer.
Yeah, well, I've got a family connection with that story, being from Christchurch, because Pauline Parker was the other girl involved. And when the two girls were put into prison, they were at opposite ends of New Zealand. But Pauline Parker was at Papanui Women's Prison, and those girls, and they were very bright, and there was some concern about their education. And because Juliet Hume and Anne Perry as well as her father was connected with the university, various university people were tapped on the shoulder to go and assist in these young ladies' education, because they're going to come out of prison and they need to have a life. So my father went off to Papanui Women's Prison and taught Pauline Parker French, and he said she was a very nice young woman.
Oh, well, there you go.
But the John Garrett, who's a professor of history, was heard to remark, well, you know, if you're an ordinary student, you get an ordinary tutor, but if you're a murderess, you get the professor.
And so you've got the work on Mary Fortune. Anything else that's going, or is that taking up all your time?
At the moment, yeah. I've got a couple of books which are floating around, and we're waiting to hear back. These are one's a fiction, and the other one is a writing up of a true crime from the 16th century.
Well, we won't talk about those at this time, because it's bad luck to talk about things before they're either completed or sold. Once they're sold, you can start giving the outline of them. But until that stage, it's not a good thing to do.
Even when you've sold, it's, you know, things can go wrong. You know, contracts can get cancelled, the publishers can go broke. So you don't... It's not until it's in your hot little hands and the review copies have been sent out can you actually regard it as published.
Mm. Well, good luck with both of those.
Thank you.
We hope they do well, and we hope we can come back and have a talk about those sometime in the future.
Delighted to.
Excellent.
Thanks very much, Lucy.
Thank you.
Great talk. Thanks very much this afternoon. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Okay, well, that brings us to the end of another episode of Two Chairs Talking. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Couple of plans for what we might be talking about then, but given the way our lives move, things may change. So we won't basically tell you exactly what it is we're going to be doing, but we'll have something interesting, hopefully.
Indeed.
All right, David, that's it. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
See you then.